In his veins, like the Isle of Red London, ran a shimmering, healthy crimson, while his right eye was the colour of spilled ink, a glistening black. He wanted to believe that his strength came from his blood alone, but he could not ignore the signature of dark magic that marred his face. It gazed back at him from every looking-glass and every pair of ordinary eyes as they widened in awe or fear. It hummed in his skull whenever he summoned power. But his blood never darkened. It ran true and red, just as the isle did. Arcing over the river in a bridge of glass and bronze and stone stretched the royal palace. It was known as the Sona Rast, the beating heart of the city. Its curved spires glittered like beads of light. People flocked to the river palace day and night, some to bring cases to the king or queen, but many simply to be near the isle that ran beneath. Scholars came to the river's edge to study the source, and magicians came hoping to tap into its strength, while visitors from the Arnesian countryside only wanted to gaze upon the palace and river alike, and to lay flowers, from lilies to shooting stars, azaleas to moondrops, all along the bank. Kell lingered in the shadow of a shop across the road from the riverside and looked up at the palace, like a sun caught in constant rise over the city, and for a moment he saw it the way visitors must, with wonder. And then a flicker of pain ran through his arm, and he came back to his senses. He winced, slipped the travelling coin back around his neck, and made his way toward the isle, the banks of the river teeming with life. The night market was in full swing. Vendors in coloured tents sold wares by the light of river and lantern and moon, some food and others trinkets, the magic and mundane alike, to locals and to pilgrims. A young woman held a bushel of star flowers for visitors to set on the palace steps. An old man displayed dozens of necklaces on a raised arm, each adorned with a burnished pebble, tokens said to amplify control over an element. The subtle scent of flowers was lost beneath the aroma of cooking meat and freshly cut fruit, heavy spices and mulled wine. A man in dark robes offered candied plums beside a woman selling scrying stones. A vendor poured steaming tea into short glass goblets across from another vibrant stall displaying masks, and a third offering tiny vials of water drawn from the isle, the contents still glowing faintly with its light. Every night of the year the market lived and breathed and thrived. The stores were always changing, but the energy remained as much a part of the city as the river it fed on. Cal traced the edge of the bank, weaving through the evening fair, savouring the taste and smell of the air, the sound of laughter and music, the thrum of magic. A street mage was doing fire tricks for a cluster of children. And when the flames burst up from his cupped hands into the shape of a dragon, a small boy stumbled back in surprise and fell right into Kell's path. He caught the boy's sleeve before he hit the street stones and hoisted him to his feet. The boy was halfway through mumbling a thank you, sir, sorry, when he looked up and caught sight of Kell's black eye beneath his hair. And the boy's own eyes, both light brown, went wide. "Mathieu!" scolded a woman as the boy tore free of Kell's hand and fled behind her cloak. "Sorry, sir," she said in Arnesian, shaking her head. "I don't know what's gotten." And then she saw Kell's face and the words died. She had the decency not to turn and flee like her son, but what she did was much worse. The woman bowed in the street so deeply that Kell thought she would fall over.
"Ah, then, Kell," she said, breathless.
His stomach twisted and he reached for her arm, hoping to make her straighten before anyone else could see the gesture. But he was only halfway to her and already too late.
"He was not looking,"
she stammered, struggling to find the words in English, the royal tongue. It only made Kell cringe more. "It was my fault," he said gently in Arnesian, taking her elbow and urging her up out of the bow.
"He did not recognize you,"
she said, clearly grateful to be speaking the common tongue.
"Dressed as you are?"
Kell looked down at himself. He was still wearing the brown and fraying coat from the stone's throw as opposed to his uniform. He hadn't forgotten. He'd simply wanted to enjoy the fair, just for a few minutes, as one of the pilgrims or locals. But the ruse was at an end. He could feel the news ripple through the crowd, the mood shifting like a tide as the patrons of the night market realized who was among them. By the time he let go of the woman's arm, the crowd was parting for him, the laughter and shouting reduced to reverent whispers. Rye knew how to deal with these moments, how to twist them, how to own them. Kell wanted only to disappear. He tried to smile, but knew it must look like a grimace, so he bid the woman and her son good night and made his way quickly down the river's edge, the murmurings of the vendors and patrons trailing him as he went. He didn't look back, but the voices followed all the way to the flower-strewn steps of the royal palace. The guards did not move from their posts, acknowledging him with only a slight tilt of their heads as he ascended the stairs. He was grateful that most of them did not bow. Only Rye's guard, Parrish, seemed unable to resist, but at least he had the decency to be discreet. As Kell climbed the steps, he shrugged off his coat and turned it inside out from right to left. When he slid his arms into the sleeves again, they were no longer tattered and soot-stained. Instead, they were lovely, polished, the same shimmering red as the aisle running beneath the palace. A red, reserved for royalty. Kell paused at the top step, fastened the gleaming gold buttons, and went in. 3. He found them in the courtyard, taking a late tea under the cloudless night and the fall canopy of trees. The king and queen were sitting at a table while Rye was stretched on a sofa, rambling on again about his birthday and the slew of festivities intended to surround it. "It's called a birthday," chided King Maxim, a towering man with broad shoulders and bright eyes and a black beard, without looking up from a stack of papers he was reading. "Not a birthday's, and certainly not a birth week."
20 years, countered Rye, waving his empty teacup. 20! A few days of celebration hardly seems excessive.
His amber eyes glittered mischievously.
"And besides, half of them are for the people, anyway. Who am I to deny them?"
"And the other half?"
asked Queen Emira, her long dark hair threaded with gold ribbon and gathered in a heavy braid behind her. Rye flashed his winning smile.
"You're the one determined to find me a match, Mother."
"Yes," she said, absently straightening the teaware.
"But I'd rather not turn the palace into a brothel to do it."
"Not a brothel,"
said Rye, running his fingers through his rich black hair and upsetting the circle of gold that rested there.
"Merely an efficient way of assessing the many necessary attributes of..." "Ah, Kell. Kell will support my thinking."
"I think it's a horrible idea," said Kell, striding toward them.
"Traitor," said Rye with mock affront.
"But," he added, approaching the table, "he'll do it anyway. You might as well throw the party here at the palace, where we can all keep him out of trouble. Or at least minimize it."
Rye beamed.
"Sound logic, sound logic," he said, mimicking his father's deep voice.
The king set aside the paper he was holding and considered Kell.
"How was your trip?"
"Longer than I would have liked," said Kell, sorting through his coats and pockets until he found the Prince Regent's letter.
"We were beginning to worry," said Queen Emira.
"The king was not well and the prince was worse," said Kell, offering the note.
King Maxim took it and set it aside, unread.
"Sit," urged the queen. "You look pale."
"Are you well?"
asked the king.
"Quite, sir,"
said Kell, sinking gratefully into a chair at the table.
"Only tired."
The queen reached out and brought her hand to Kell's cheek.
Her complexion was darker than his. The royal family bore a rich tan that, when paired with their honey eyes and black hair, made them look like polished wood. With fair skin and reddish hair, Kel felt perpetually out of place. The Queen brushed a handful of copper strands off his forehead. She always went looking for the truth in his right eye, as if it were a scrying board, something to be gazed into, seen past. But what she saw, she never shared. Kel took her hand and kissed it. "I'm fine, Your Majesty." She gave him a weary look, and he corrected himself. "Mother." A servant appeared bearing tea, sweet and laced with mint, and Kel took a long drink and let his family talk, his mind wandering in the comfort of their noise. When he could barely keep his eyes open, he excused himself. Rye pushed up from the sofa with him. Kel wasn't surprised. He had felt the prince's gaze on him since he'd first taken his seat. Now, as the two bid their parents good night, Rye trailed Kel into the hall, fiddling with the circle of gold nested in his black curls. "What did I miss?" asked Kel.
"Not much," said Rye. "Holland paid a visit. He only just left."
Kel frowned. Red London and white kept in much closer contact than red and grey, but their communication still held a kind of routine. Holland was off schedule by nearly a week.
"What have you come back with tonight?" asked Rye.
"A headache," said Kel, rubbing his eyes.
"You know what I mean," countered the prince. "What did you bring through that door?"
"Nothing but a few lins."
Kel spread his arms wide. "Search me if you like," he added with a smirk. Rye had never been able to figure out Kel's coat and its many sides, and Kel was already turning back down the hall considering the matter done when Rye surprised him by reaching not for his pockets but for his shoulders and pushing him back against the wall. Hard. A nearby painting of the king and queen shuddered but did not fall. The guards dotting the hall looked up but did not move from their posts. Kel was a year older than Rye, but built like an afternoon shadow, tall and slim, while Rye was built like a statue and nearly as strong.
"Do not lie," warned Rye. "Not to me."
Kel's mouth became a hard line. Rye had caught him 2 years before. Not caught in the act, of course, but snagged him in another more devious way. Trust. The two had been drinking on one of the palace's many balconies one summer night, the glow of the aisle beneath them and the stretch of sky above, and the truth had stumbled out. Kel had told his brother about the deals he struck in grey London and in white, and even on occasion in red, about the various things he'd smuggled, and Rye had stared at him and listened, and when he spoke, it wasn't to lecture Kel on all the ways it was wrong or illegal. It was to ask, why?
"I don't know," said Kel,
and it had been the truth. Rye had sat up, eyes bleary from drink.
"Have we not provided?" he'd asked, visibly upset. "Is there anything you want for?"
"No,"
Kel had answered, and that had been the truth and a lie at the same time.
"Are you not loved?" whispered Rye. "Are you not welcomed as family?"
"But I'm not family, Rye," Kel had said. "I'm not truly a Maharesh for all that the king and queen have offered me that name. I feel more like a possession than a prince."
At that, Rye had punched him in the face. For a week after, Kel had two black eyes instead of one, and he'd never spoken like that again, but the damage was done. He'd hoped Rye would prove too drunk to remember the conversation, but he'd remembered everything. He hadn't told the king or queen, and Kel supposed he owed Rye that, but now, every time he travelled, he had to endure Rye's questioning, and with it the reminder that what he was doing was foolish and wrong. Rye let go of Kel's shoulders.
"Why do you insist on keeping up these pursuits?"
"They amuse me," said Kel, brushing himself off. Rye shook his head.
"Look, I've turned a blind eye to your childish rebellion for quite a while now, but those doors were shut for a reason, he warned. Transference is treason.
They're only trinkets, said Kell, continuing down the hall. There's no real danger in it.
There's plenty, said Rye, matching his stride. Like the danger that awaits you if our parents ever learn...
Would you tell them? Asked Kell.
Rye sighed. Kell watched him try to answer several ways before he finally said, There is nothing I would not give you.
Kell's chest ached.
I know.
You are my brother, my closest friend.
I know.
Then put an end to this foolishness before I do.
Kell managed a small, tired smile.
Careful, Rye, he said. You're beginning to sound like a king.
Rye's mouth quirked.
One day I will be, and I need you there beside me.
Kell smiled back.
Believe me, there's no place I'd rather be.
It was the truth.
Rye patted his shoulder and went to bed. Kell shoved his hands into his pockets and watched him go. The people of London and of the country beyond loved their prince.
And why shouldn't they?
He was young and handsome and kind.
Perhaps he played the part of rake too often and too well, but behind the charismatic smile and the flirtatious air was a sharp mind and a good intent, the desire to make everyone around him happy. He had little gift for magic, and even less focus for it, but what he lacked in power he more than made up for in charm. Besides, if Kell had learned anything from his trips to White London, it was that magic made rulers worse, not better.
He continued down the hall to his own rooms, where a dark set of oak doors led onto a sprawling chamber. The aisle's red glow poured through the open doors of a private balcony. Tapestry billowed and dipped in fabric clouds from the high ceiling, and a luxurious canopied bed filled with feather and lined with silk stood waiting, beckoning. It took all of Kell's will not to collapse into it. Instead, he crossed through the chamber and into a second, smaller room lined with books, a variety of tomes on magic, including what little he could find on Antari and their blood commands, the majority destroyed out of fear in the Black London Purge, and closed the door behind him. He snapped his fingers absently, and a candle perching on the edge of a shelf sparked to life. In its light he could make out a series of marks on the back of the door. An inverted triangle, a set of lines, a circle. Simple marks, easy enough to recreate, but specific enough to differentiate. Doors to different places in Red London. His eyes went to the one in the middle. It was made up of two crossed lines. X marks the spot, he thought to himself, pressing his fingers to the most recent cut on his arm, the blood still wet, then tracing the mark.
As Tasen, he said tiredly.
The wall gave way beneath his touch, and his private library became a cramped little room, the lush quiet of his royal chambers replaced by the din of the tavern below and the city beyond, much nearer than it had been a mere moment before. Iskir Ayes, the Ruby Fields, was the name that swung above the tavern's door. The place was run by an old woman named Fauna. She had the body of a gran, the mouth of a sailor, and the temper of a drunk. Kell had cut a deal with her when he was young. She was still old then, always old, and the room at the top of the stairs became his. The room itself was rough and worn and several strides too small, but it belonged entirely to him. Spellwork, and not strictly legal at that, marked the window and the door so that no one else could find the room or perceive that it was there. At first glance, the chamber looked fairly empty, but a closer inspection would reveal that the space under the cot and the drawers in the dresser were filled with boxes, and in those boxes were treasures from every London. Kell supposed that he was a collector, too. The only items on display were a book of poems,
a glass ball filled with black sand, and a set of maps. The poems were by a man named Blake, and had been given to Kell by a collector in Grey London the year before, the spine already worn to nothing. The glass ball was a trinket from White London said to show one's dreams in the sands, but Kell had yet to try it. The maps were a reminder. The three canvases were tacked side by side, the sole decoration on the walls. From a distance they could have passed for the same map, the same outline of the same island country, but up close only the word London could be found on all three. Grey London, Red London, White London. The map on the left was of Great Britain from the English Channel up through the tips of Scotland, every facet rendered in detail. By contrast, the map on the right held almost none. Marked, the country called itself, the capital city held by the ruthless Dane twins, but the territory beyond was in constant flux. The map in the middle Cal knew best, for it was home, Arn. The country's name was written in elegant script down the length of the island, though in truth the land on which London stood was only the tip of the Royal Empire. Three very different Londons in three very different countries, and Kell was one of the only living souls to have seen them all. The great irony, he supposed, was that he had never seen the worlds beyond the cities. Bound to the service of his king and crown, and constantly kept within reach, he had never been more than a day's journey from one London or another. Fatigue ate at Kell's body as he stretched and shrugged off his coat. He dug through the pockets until he found the collector's parcel, which he set carefully on the bed, gingerly undoing the wrapping to reveal the tiny silver music box inside. The room's lanterns grew brighter as he held up the trinket to the light, admiring it. The ache in his arm drew him back, and he set the music box aside and turned his attention to the dresser. A basin of water and a set of jars waited there, and Kell rolled up the sleeve of his black tunic and set to work on his forearm. He moved with expert hands, and in minutes he'd rinsed the skin and applied a salve. There was a blood command for healing, As Hasarai, but it wasn't meant for Antari to use on themselves, especially not for minor wounds, as it took more energy than it afforded health. As it was, the cuts on his arm were already beginning to mend. Antari healed quickly thanks to the amount of magic in their veins, and by morning the shallow marks would be gone, the skin smooth. He was about to pull down his sleeve when the small, shiny scar captured his attention. It always did. Just below the crook of his elbow, the lines were so blurred that the symbol was almost unreadable. Almost. Kell had lived in the palace since he was 5. He first noticed the mark when he was 12. He had spent weeks searching for the rune in the palace libraries. Memory. He ran his thumb over the scar. Contrary to its name, the symbol wasn't meant to help one remember. It was meant to make one forget. Forget a moment, a day, a life. But magic that bound a person's body or mind was not only forbidden, it was a capital offence. Those accused and convicted were stripped of their power, a fate some found worse than death in a world ruled by magic. And yet Kell bore the mark of such a spell. Worse, he suspected that the king and queen themselves had sanctioned it. K.L. The initials on his knife. There were so many things he didn't understand, would never understand about the weapon, its monogram, and the life that went with it. Were the letters English or Arnesian? The letters could be found in both alphabets. What did the L stand for, or even the K, for that matter? He knew nothing of the letters that had formed his name. K.L. had become K.L. and K.L. had become Kell. He was only a child when he was brought to the palace. Had the knife always been his, or had it been his father's? A token? Something to take with him, something to help him remember who he'd been. Who had he been? The absence of memory ate at him. He often caught himself staring at the centre map on the wall, wondering where he'd come from, who he'd come from. Whoever they were, they hadn't been Antari. Magic might live in the blood, but not in the bloodline. It wasn't passed from parent to child. It chose its own way, chose its shape. The strong sometimes gave birth to the weak, or the other way around. Fire wielders were often born from water mages, earth movers from healers. Power could not be cultivated like a crop, distilled through generations. If it could, Antari would be sown and reaped. They were ideal vessels capable of controlling any element, of drawing any spell, of using their own blood to command the world around them. They were tools, and in the wrong hands, weapons. Perhaps the lack of inheritance was nature's way of balancing the scales, of maintaining order. In truth, none knew what led to the birth of an Antari. Some believe that it was random, a lucky throw of dice. Others claim that Antari were divine, destined for greatness. Some scholars, like Tirin, believe that Antari were the result of transference between the worlds, magic of different kinds intertwining, and that was why they were dying out. But no matter the theory on how they came to be, most believed that Antari were sacred, chosen by magic or blessed by it, perhaps, but certainly marked by it. Kel brought his fingers absently to his right eye. Whatever one chose to believe, the fact remained that Antari had grown even more rare and therefore more precious. Their talent had always made them something to be coveted, but now their scarcity made them something to be gathered and guarded and kept. Possessed. And whether or not Rai wanted to admit it, Kel belonged to the royal collection. He took up the silver music box, winding the tiny metal crank. A valuable trinket, he thought, but a trinket all the same. The song started tickling his palm like a bird, but he didn't set down the box. Instead, he held it tight, the notes whispering out as he fell back onto the stiff cot and considered the small, beautiful contraption. How had he ended up on this shelf? What had happened when his eye turned black? Was he born that way and hidden, or did the mark of magic manifest? 5 years. 5 years he'd been someone else's son. Had they been sad to let him go, or had they gratefully offered him up to the crown? The king and queen refused to tell him of his past, and he'd learned to stop voicing his questions. But fatigue wore away his walls and let them through. What life had he forgotten? Kel's hand fell away from his face as he chided himself. How much could a child of 5 really have to remember? Whoever he'd been before he was brought to the palace, that person didn't matter any more. That person didn't exist. The music box's song faltered and came to a stop, and Kel rewound it again and closed his eyes, letting the grey London melody and the red London air drag him down to sleep. 3. Grey Thief. 1. Lila Bard lived by a simple rule. If a thing was worth having, it was worth taking. She held the silver pocket watch up to the faint glow of the street lamp, admiring the metal's polished shine, wondering what the engraved initials LLE on the back might stand for. She'd nicked the watch off a gentleman, a clumsy collision on a too crowded curb that had led to a swift apology, a hand on the shoulder to distract from a hand on the coat. Lila's fingers weren't just fast, they were light. A tip of the top hat and a pleasant good night, and she was the proud new owner of a timepiece, and he was on his way and none the wiser. She didn't care about the object itself, but she cared a great deal for what it bought her. Freedom. A poor excuse for it, to be sure, but better than a prison or a poorhouse. She ran a gloved thumb over the crystal watch face.
"Do you have the time?"
asked a man at her shoulder. Lila's eyes flicked up. It was a constable. Her hand went to the brim of her top hat, stolen from a dozing chauffeur the week before, and she hoped the gesture passed for a greeting and not a nervous slip, an attempt to hide her face.
"9:30,
she murmured deeply, tucking the watch into the vest pocket under her cloak, careful not to let the constable catch sight of the various weapons glittering beneath it. Lila was tall and thin, with a boyish frame that helped her pass for a young man, but only from a distance. Too close an inspection, and the illusion would crumble. Lila knew she should turn and go while she could, but when the constable searched for something to light his pipe and came up empty, she found herself fetching up a sliver of wood from the street. She put one boot up on the base of the lamppost and stepped lively up to light the stick in the flame. Lantern light glanced off her jawline, lips, cheekbones, the edges of her face exposed beneath the top hat. A delicious thrill ran through her chest, spurned on by the closeness of danger, and Lila wondered, not for the first time, if something was wrong with her. Baron used to say so, but Baron was a bore. "Looking for trouble," he'd say. "You're gonna look till you find it." "Trouble is the looker," she'd answer. "It keeps looking till it finds you. Might as well find it first."
"Why do you want to die?"
"I don't," she'd say. "I just want to live." She stepped down from the lamppost, her face plunging back into her hat shadow as she handed the constable the burning sliver of wood. He offered a muttered thanks and lit the pipe, gave a few puffs, and seemed about to go, but then he paused. Lila's heart gave a nervous flutter as he considered her again, this time more carefully.
"You ought to be mindful, sir," he said at last. "Out alone at night? Likely to get your pocket picked." "Robbers?" asked Lila, struggling to keep her voice low. "Surely not in Eton?"
"Aye." The constable nodded and pulled a folded sheet of paper from his coat. Lila reached out and took it, even though she knew at first glance what it was. A wanted poster. She stared down at a sketch that was little more than a shadowy outline wearing a mask, a haphazard swatch of fabric over the eyes, and a broad-brim hat.
"Been picking pockets, even robbed a few gentlemen and a lady outright. Expect that mess, of course, but not round here. A right audacious crook, this one."
Lila fought back a smile. It was true. Nicking spare change in South Bank was one thing. Stealing silver and gold from the carriage bound in Mayfair, quite another. But thieves were fools to stay in slums. The poor kept up their guards. The rich strutted around assuming they'd be safe so long as they stayed in the good parts of town. But Lila knew there were no good parts, only smart parts and stupid parts, and she was quick enough to know which one to play. She handed back the paper and tipped the stolen top hat to the constable.
"I'll mind my pockets, then."
"Do," urged the constable. "Not like it used to be." "Nothing is."
He ambled away, sucking on his pipe and muttering about the way the world was falling apart, or some such. Lila couldn't hear the rest over the thudding pulse in her ears. The moment he was out of sight, Lila sighed and slumped back against the lamppost, dizzy with relief. She dragged the top hat from her head and considered the mask and the broad brim cap stuffed inside. She smiled to herself. And then she put the hat back on, pushed off the post, and made her way to the docks, whistling as she walked. 2. The Sea King wasn't nearly as impressive as the name suggested. The ship leaned heavily against the dock, its paint stripped by salt, its wooden hull half rotted in some places and fully rotted in others. The whole thing seemed to be sinking very, very slowly into the Thames. The only thing keeping the boat up appeared to be the dock itself, the state of which wasn't much better, and Lila wondered if one day the side of the ship and the boards of the dock would simply rot together or crumble away into the murky bay. Powell claimed that the Sea King was as sturdy as ever. Still fit for the high seas, he swore. Lyda thought it was hardly fit for the sway of the London port swells. She put her boot up on the ramp and the boards groaned underfoot, the sound rippling back until it seemed like the whole boat was protesting her arrival. A protest she ignored as she climbed aboard, loosening the cloaks knot at her throat. Lila's body ached for sleep, but she carried out her nightly ritual, crossing the dock to the ship's bow and curling her fingers around the wheel. The cold wood against her palms, the gentle roll of the deck beneath her feet, it all felt right. Lila Bard knew in her bones that she was meant to be a pirate. All she needed was a working ship. And once she had one, a breeze caught up her coat, and for a moment she saw herself far from the London port, far from any land, ploughing forward across the high seas. She closed her eyes and tried to imagine the feel of the sea breeze rushing through her threadbare sleeves, the beat of the ocean against the ship's sides, the thrill of freedom, true freedom, and adventure. She tipped her chin up as an imaginary spray of salty water tickled her chin. She drew a deep breath and smiled at the taste of the sea air. By the time she opened her eyes, she was surprised to find the Sea King just as it had been, docked and dead. Lila pushed off the rail and made her way across the deck, and for the first time all night, as her boots echoed on the wood, she felt something like safe. She knew it wasn't safe, knew nowhere in the city was, not a plush carriage in Mayfair, and certainly not a half-rotten ship on the dodgy end of the docks. But it felt a little something like it. Familiar. Was that it? Or maybe simply hidden? This was as close to safe as it got. No eyes watched her cross the deck. None saw her descend the steep set of steps that ran into the ship's bones and bowels. None followed her through the dank little hall or into the cabin at the end. The knot at her throat finally came loose, and Lila pulled the cloak from her shoulders and tossed it onto a cot that hugged one of the cabin walls. It fell fluttering to the bed, soon followed by the top hat, which spilled its disguise like jewels onto the dark fabric. A small cold stove sat in the corner, the embers barely enough to warm the room. Lila stirred them up and used the stick to light a couple of tallow candles scattered around the cabin. She then tugged off her gloves and lobbed them onto the cot with the rest. Finally, she slid off her belt, freeing holster and dagger both from the leather strap. They weren't her only weapons, of course, but they were the only ones she bothered to take off. The knife was nothing special, just wickedly sharp. She tossed it onto the bed with the rest of the discarded things. But the pistol was a gem. A flintlock revolver that had fallen out of a wealthy dead man's hand and into hers the year before. Caster, for all good weapons deserved a name, was a beauty of a gun, and she slipped him gently, almost reverently, into the drawer of her desk. The thrill of the night had gone cold with the walk to the docks. Excitement burned to ash, and Lila found herself slouching into a chair. It protested as much as everything else on the ship, groaning roundly as she kicked her boots up onto the desk, the worn wooden surface of which was piled with maps, mostly rolled, but one spread and pinned in place by stones or stolen trinkets. It was her favourite one, that map, because none of the places on it were labelled. Surely someone knew what kind of map it was and where it led, but Lila didn't. To her, it was a map to anywhere. A large slab of mirror sat propped on the desk, leaning back against the hull wall, its edges fogged and silvering. Lila found her gaze in the glass and cringed a little. She ran her fingers through her hair. It was ragged and dark and scraped against her jaw. Lila was 19. 19, and every one of the years felt carved into her. She poked at the skin under her eyes, tugged at her cheeks, ran a finger along her lips. It had been a long time since anyone had called her pretty. Not that Lila wanted to be pretty. Pretty wouldn't serve her well. And Lord knew she didn't envy the ladies with their cinched corsets and abundant skirts, their falsetto laughs and the ridiculous way they used them, the way they swooned and leaned on men, feigning weakness to savour their strength. Why anyone would ever pretend to be weak was beyond her. Lila tried to picture herself as one of the ladies she'd stolen from that night. So easy to get tangled up in all that fabric. So easy to stumble and be caught. And smiled. How many ladies had flirted with her? Swooned and leaned and pretended to marvel at her strength. She felt the weight of the night's take in her pocket. Enough. It served them right for playing weak. Maybe they wouldn't be so quick to swoon at every top hat and take hold of every offered hand. Lila tipped her head back against the back of the chair. She could hear Powell in his quarters acting out his own nightly routine of drinking and cursing and muttering stories to the bowed walls of the rotting ship. Stories of lands he'd never visited, maidens he'd never wooed, treasures he'd never plundered. He was a liar, and a drunkard, and a fool. She'd seen him be all three on any given night in the barren tide. But he had an extra cabin, and she had need of one, and they had reached an agreement. She lost a cut of every night's take to his hospitality, and in return he forgot that he was renting the room to a wanted criminal, let alone a girl. Powell rambled on within his room. He carried on for hours, but Lila was so used to the noise that soon it faded in with the other groans and moans and murmurings of the old sea king. Her head had just started to slump when someone knocked on her door three times. Well, someone knocked twice but was clearly too drunk to finish the third, dragging their hand down the wood. Lila's boots slid from the desk and landed heavily on the floor.
"What is it?"
she called, getting to her feet as the door swung open. Powell stood there, swaying from drink and the gentle rock of the boat.
"Lila!"
he sang her name.
"Lila!"
"What?"
A bottle sloshed in one hand. He held out the other, palm up.
"My cat!"
Lila shoved her hand into her pocket and came out with a handful of coins. Most of them were faded, but a few bits of silver glinted in the mix, and she picked them out and dropped them into Powell's palm. He closed his fist and jingled the money.
"It's not enough,"
he said as she returned the coppers to her pocket. She felt the silver watch in her vest warm against her ribs, but didn't pull it out. She wasn't sure why. Maybe she'd taken a liking to the timepiece after all. Or maybe she was afraid that if she started offering such pricey goods, Powell would come to expect them.
"Slow night," she said, crossing her arms. "I'll make up the difference tomorrow."
"Your trouble," slurred Powell.
"Indeed," she said, flashing a grin.
Her tone was sweet, but her teeth were sharp.
"Maybe more trouble than you're worth,"
he slurred.
"Certainly more than you're worth tonight."
"I'll get you the rest tomorrow,"
she said, hands slipping back to her side.
"You're drunk. Go to bed."
She started to turn away, but Powell caught her elbow.
"I'll take it tonight,"
he said with a sneer.
"I said I don't."
The bottle tumbled from Powell's other hand as he forced her back into the desk, pinning her with his hips.
"Doesn't have to be coin,"
he whispered, dragging his eyes down her shirt front.
"Must be a girl's body under there somewhere."
His hands began to roam, and Lila drove her knee into his stomach and sent him staggering backward.
"Shouldn't have done that,"
growled Powell, face red. His fingers fumbled with his buckle. Lila didn't wait.
She went for the pistol in the drawer, but Powell's head snapped up and he lunged and caught her wrist, dragging her toward him. He threw her bodily back onto the cot, and she landed on the hat and the gloves and the cloak and the discarded knife. Lila scrambled for the dagger as Powell charged forward. He grabbed her knee as her fingers wrapped around the leather sheath. He jerked her toward him as she drew the blade free. And when he caught her other hand with his, she used his grip to pull herself to her feet and drive the knife into his gut. And just like that, all the struggle went out of the cramped little room. Powell stared down at the blade jutting out of his front, eyes wide with surprise. And for a moment it looked like he might carry on despite it, but Lila knew how to use a knife, knew where to cut to hurt, and where to cut to kill. Powell's grip on her tightened, and then it went slack. He swayed and frowned, and then his knees buckled.
"Shouldn't have done that,"
she echoed, pulling the knife free before he could collapse forward onto it. Powell's body hit the floor and stayed there. Lila stared down at it a moment, marvelling at the stillness, the quiet broken only by her pulse and the hush of the water against the lull of the ship. She towed the man with her boot. Dead. Dead. And making a mess. Blood was spreading across the boards, filling in the cracks and dripping through to lower parts of the ship. Lila needed to do something. Now. She crouched, wiped her blade on Powell's shirt and recovered the silver from his pocket. And then she stepped over his body, retrieved the revolver from its drawer, and got dressed. When the belt was back around her waist and the cloak around her shoulders, she took up the bottle of whiskey from the floor. It hadn't broken when it fell. Lila pulled the cork free with her teeth and emptied the contents onto Powell, even though there was probably enough alcohol in his blood to burn without it. She took up a candle and was about to touch it to the floor when she remembered the map, the one to anywhere. She freed it from the desk and tucked it under her cloak. And then, with a last look around the room, she set fire to the dead man and the boat. Lila stood on the dock and watched the Sea King burn. She stared up at it, face warmed by the fire that danced on her chin and cheeks the way the lamplight had before the constable. "It's a shame," she thought. She'd rather liked the rotting ship. But it wasn't hers. No, hers would be much better. The Sea King groaned as the flames gnawed its skin and then its bones, and Lila watched the dead ship begin to sink. She stayed until she could hear the far-off cries and the sound of boots. Too late, of course, but coming all the same. And then she sighed and went in search of another place to spend the night. 3. Baron was standing on the steps of the stone's throw, staring absently toward the docks, when Lila strolled up, the top hat and the map both tucked under her arm. When she followed his gaze, she could see the dregs of the fire over the building tops, the smoke ghosted against the cloudy night. Baron pretended not to notice her at first. She couldn't blame him. The last time he'd seen her, almost a year before, he'd kicked her out for thieving. Not from him, of course, from a patron. And she'd stormed off, damning him and his little tavern inn alike.
"Where are you going, then?"
he'd rumbled after her like thunder. It was as close as he'd ever come to shouting.
"To find an adventure,"
she called without looking back. Now she scuffed her boots along the street stones. He sucked on a cigar.
"Back so soon?"
he said without looking up. She climbed the steps, slouching back against the tavern door.
"You find adventure already, or it find you?"
Lila didn't answer. She could hear the clink of cups inside and the chatter of drunk men getting drunker. She hated that noise. hated most taverns altogether, but not the stone's throw. The others all repulsed her, repelled her, but this place dragged at her like gravity, a low and constant pull. Even when she didn't mean to, she always seemed to end up here. How many times in the last year had her feet carried her back to these steps? How many times had she almost gone inside? Not that Baron needed to know about that. She watched him tip his head back and stare up at the sky as if he could see something there besides clouds.
"What happened to the Sea King?"
he asked. "It burned down." A defiant flutter of pride filled her chest when his eyes widened a fraction in surprise. She liked surprising Baron. It wasn't an easy thing to do.
"Did it now?"
he asked lightly.
"You know how it is," said Lila with a shrug. "Old wood goes up so easy."
Baron gave her a long look, then exhaled a smoke-filled breath.
"Powell should have been more careful with his brig."
"Yeah,"
said Lila. She fiddled with the brim of the top hat.
"You smell like smoke."
"I need to rent a room."
The word stuck in her throat.
"Funny,"
said Baron, taking another puff.
"I distinctly remember you suggesting that I take my tavern and all its many, albeit modest, rooms and shove each and every one of them up my..."
"Things change,"
she said as she plucked a cigar from his mouth and took a drag. He studied her in the lamplight.
"You okay?"
Lila studied the smoke as it poured through her lips.
"I'm always okay."
She handed back the cigar and dug the silver watch out of her vest pocket. It was warm and smooth, and she didn't know why she liked it so much, but she did. Maybe because it was a choice. Taking it had been a choice. Keeping it had been one, too. Or maybe the choice started as a random one, but there was something to it. Maybe she'd kept it for a reason. Or maybe she'd only kept it for this. She held it out to Baron.
"Will this buy me a few nights?"
The owner of the stone's throw considered the watch, and then he reached out and curled Lila's fingers over it.
"Keep it,"
he said casually.
"I know you're good for the coin."
Lila slid the trinket back into her pocket, thankful for its weight, as she realized she was back to nothing. Well, almost nothing. A top hat, a map to anywhere, or nowhere, a handful of knives, a flintlock, a few coins, and a silver watch. Baron pushed the door open, but when she turned to go inside, he barred her path.
"No one hears a mark. You got that?"
Lila nodded stiffly.
"I'm not staying long," she said. "Just till the smoke clears."
The sound of glass breaking reached them beyond the doorway, and Baron sighed and went inside, calling over his shoulder,
"Welcome back."
Lila sighed and looked up, not at the sky, but at the upper windows of the dingy little tavern. It was hardly a pirate ship, a place for freedom and adventure. "Just till the smoke clears," she echoed to herself. Maybe it wasn't so bad. After all, she hadn't come back to the stone's throw with her tail tucked between her legs. She was in hiding. A wanted man. She smiled at the irony of the term. A piece of paper flapped on a post beside the door. It was the same notice the constable had showed her, and she smiled at the figure in the broad-brimmed hat and mask staring out at her beneath the word "wanted." The Shadow Thief, they called her. They'd drawn her even taller and thinner than she actually was, stretched her into a wraith, black-clad and fearsome. The stuff of fairy tales and legends. Lila winked at the shadow before going in. 4. White Throne. 1.
"Perhaps it should be a masquerade instead."
"Focus."
"Or maybe a costume ball. Something with a bit of flair."
"Come on, Rye, pay attention."
The prince sat in a high-backed chair, gold-buckled boots kicked up on the table, rolling a glass ball between his hands. The orb was part of a larger, more intricate version of the game Kell had pawned off in the stone's throw. In place of pebbles or puddles or piles of sand nesting on the little board, there were 5 glass balls, each containing an element. 4 still sat in the dark wood chest on the table, its inside lined with silk and its edges capped in gold. The one in Rye's hands held a handful of earth, and it tipped side to side with the motion of his fingers.
"Costumes with layers, one that can be taken off," he went on.
Kell sighed.
"We can all start the night in full dress and end in..."
"You're not even trying." Rye groaned. His boots hit the floor with a thud as he straightened and held the glass ball up between them.
"Fine," he said. "Observe my magical prowess."
Rye squinted at the dirt trapped inside the glass and, attempting to focus, spoke to the earth under his breath in low murmuring English. But the earth did not move. Kell watched a crease appear between Rye's eyes as he focused and whispered and waited and grew increasingly irritated. At last the dirt shifted, albeit half-heartedly, within the glass.
"I did it!" exclaimed Rye.
"You shook it," said Kell.
"I wouldn't dare."
"Try again." Rye made a sound of dismay as he slumped in his chair.
"Sanct Kell! What's wrong with me?"
"Nothing is wrong," insisted Kell.
"I speak 11 languages," said Rye, "some for countries I have never seen nor am likely to set foot in, yet I cannot coax a clod of dirt to move or a drop of water to rise from its pool."
His temper flared.
"It's maddening," he growled. "Why is the language of magic so hard for my tongue to master?"
"Because you cannot win the elements over with your charm or your smile or your status," said Kell.
"They disrespect me," said Rye with a dry smile.
"The earth beneath your feet does not care you will be king, nor the water in your cup, nor the air you breathe. You must speak to them as equal, or even better, as supplicant."
Rye sighed and rubbed his eyes. "I know, I know. I only wish..."
He trailed off.
Kell frowned.
Rye looked genuinely upset. "Wish what?"
Rye's gaze lifted to meet Kell's, the pale gold glittering even as a wall went up behind them.
"I wish I had a drink," he said, burying the matter.
He shoved up from his chair and crossed the chamber to pour himself one from a banquet against the wall.
"I do try, Kell. I want to be good, or at least better."
"But we can't all be..."
Rye took a sip and waved his hand at Kell. The word he assumed Rye was looking for was Antari. The word he used was...
"You."
"What can I say?" said Kell, running his hand through his hair. "I'm one of a kind."
"Two of a kind," corrected Rye.
Kell's brow creased. "I've been meaning to ask, what was Holland doing here?"
Rye shrugged and wandered back toward the chest of elements. "The same thing he always is, delivering mail."
Kell considered the prince.
Something was off. Rye was a notorious fidgeter whenever he was lying, and Kell watched him shift his weight from foot to foot and tap his fingers against the open lid of the chest. But rather than press the issue, Kell let it drop, and instead reached down and plucked another of the glass balls from the chest, this one filled with water. He balanced it in his palm, fingers splayed.
"You're trying too hard."
Kell bit the water in the glass to move, and it moved, swirling first loosely within the orb and then faster and tighter, creating a small contained cyclone.
"That's because it is hard," said Rye. "Just because you make it look easy doesn't mean it is."
Kell wouldn't tell Rye that he didn't even need to speak in order to move the water. that he could simply think the words, feel them. And the element listened and answered. Whatever flowed through the water, and the sand, and the earth, and the rest flowed through him too.